I said, well, the estimate is that you probably only have like a 10% chance of pulling through it.
52 years later, Chris Lundy is the longest living recipient of an allogeneic transplant for aplastic anemia at Fred Hutch Cancer Center. Lundy's path to diagnosis and treatment was not simple. At age 18, during basic training in Fort Polk, Louisiana, Lundy slipped and broke his wrist. At the hospital, the doctors set his wrist and ran some blood tests. What Lundy thought would be a simple visit turned into a series of months-long hospital stays. They diagnosed him with reactionary hemolytic anemia, which they said could have been caused by insecticide that was sprayed in and around the tents Lundy stayed in during basic training. Later, Lundy was transferred to a hospital in Fort Sam Houston in Texas, where doctors revised his diagnosis and determined that he had paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. At the time, Lundy said he was around the 800th documented case of someone having this disease. Lundy's doctors then transferred him to Seattle, where Dr. Don Thomas, who went on to win the Nobel, was conducting pioneering research on bone marrow transplants. In 1971, left with no other option and a week left to live, Lundy received the bone marrow transplant that would save his life. His brother, Jerry, was the donor. Chris and Jerry Lundy spoke with Dr. Deborah Doroshow, an oncologist at the Tisch Cancer Institute Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, who is also a historian of medicine.
I'm wondering if we can just get started by hearing a little bit about who you both are.
Why don't you go ahead, Jerry?
Jerry Lundy, Conway, South Carolina. Have lived here my whole life. I have worked on a farm, drove a truck, operated equipment. There's really nothing outstanding. In my life, I have enjoyed life, hunting, fishing, boating. I really don't think there's anything special about my life, that would stand out.
Well, I think all of that is terribly interesting because I don't know many farmers. I'm wondering what you farm.
Tobacco, soybeans, corn. We had a couple acre garden growing up, so there was always something to do in the garden. So, we had hogs and cows and chickens and, depended upon the farm for most everything we had.
And you both grew up there in South Carolina?
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Fantastic. Do you have any other siblings?
Have an older sister. Her name is Desi. She's 80 years old. Actually, she's been really sick in hospitals and nursing homes and all. But she's in the nursing home where Mama and Daddy both died in. Now my sister's there.
Thanks so much for telling us that, Jerry. Chris, do you want to tell us a little bit about who you are?
Well, my name is Chris Lundy, and as Jerry indicated, we grew up on the farm. When I was 17, I left the farm to go away to school, and that was in August, and in November-ish, they had the first draft. And
what year was
long
that?
Long story short, my number came up 2.
Mm. What year was that, Chris?
This was 1966. So my number comes up 2, and that meant that you definitely were going to be going in the draft. And I thought first of going in the Marine Corps. And we had a cousin that was in the Marine Corps, and came back from his first tour about the time that I got home to start getting prepared to leave and do something. And he talked me out of going in the Marine Corps because of what was going on in Southeast Asia. And to pick a better choice if I could. And so I went and interviewed with the different branches, and I scored very, very high on the ASVAB. And everyone was telling me that I could do anything I wanted. And I thought, well, I'd really like to fly. And so the only rub was that I couldn't fly unless I had a four-year degree in all of the services except the Army. They were taking individuals such as myself that did not have a college degree and making them warrant officers and training them to fly helicopters. They needed lots of helicopter pilots at the time. And so that kind of directed my path, and I ended up joining, et cetera, the Army. I was got one slot out of that was available out of several hundred that were in the pool that had been qualified, et cetera. So I go off fat, dumb, and happy, and we get in basic training in Fort Polk, Louisiana. And there was a training incident that happened later on when we were playing with some Green Beret types, doing calisthenics, competing with them, et cetera. And I ended up slipping and falling and breaking my wrist. And so I go to the hospital to have my wrist set. And I'm told that, you know, have the wrist set and you'll go back to your unit in a day or two when the swelling goes down. And it going into the hospital, they did some tests. As it was normal protocol, I guess. But what they found was that I had an extremely low hematocrit. I was jaundiced. I had double walking pneumonia. And I was a pretty sick puppy. And if I hadn't been broken my wrist, had gone to the hospital, I probably wouldn't have been around too much longer, because I think my hematocrit was about 4.5 or 5. And normal was supposed to be up around 15. So.
Are you feeling poorly at the time?
tired, stressed, all of that stuff, because we were in a cycle where we were getting like four or five hours sleep a night, heavy exercise and all that kind of stuff. So tired, yes. Other than that, I was in really good shape, so I guess it didn't affect me like it could have or should have. But other than being kind of tired and sleepy, no, not really.
What happened next?
Instead of going back to my unit, I was taken down the hallway to another hallway and down that hallway to this room and put in the room. And it was several hours later that different people started coming around and they started doing things outside the door, and like they put up this yellow and purple tape around the door. And one of the first things that did happen is someone came in and they took like 40 tubes of blood.
Wow.
And I'm in this room that I was in for the next 6.5 months without being able to walk out the door. And at the time, they came up with a diagnosis. It was changed a couple of times in the process of being at Fort Polk, and they did all they could do for me, but they determined that I had some flavor of a reactionary hemolytic anemia, and I should be sent to Fort Sam Houston. And so that's where I went after about 8 months of being in my little room. And
when you were in your little room, were they doing anything to try to treat this problem?
I felt like a big pincushion. They did a couple of bone marrow biopsies, and they took a lot of blood, and they did some different therapies. One of the ones I remember was taking a prednisone, and the idea was to help jumpstart the making the blood again. I wasn't making any red blood cells. And what happened, I ended up getting fat cheeks and being hungry all the time. But the rest of it was kind of a blur in terms of treatment, because it seemed to be something different every week. They would have someone else come in, and I saw a large number of doctors with different ideas on what I had. And later I found out at the time that what I had was, they determined later at Fort Sam Houston, that I had paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. And in the medical books, there was literally about 4 sentences after the name, and that's about all they had. And I was the 800th recorded case of someone having this.
What did they say to you to explain what this condition was and what it meant?
What did they say to explain what it was?
Yeah. How did they explain it to you?
I had been sprayed with insecticide, and the insecticide had stopped me from making blood.
Mm. When were you exposed to insecticide?
During the training. This was springtime in Fort Polk, Louisiana. We were moved out to a football field and put in tents, and they sprayed around the tents and also in the tents for the mosquitoes. The mosquitoes were very big, and the joke was that two of them could carry away small children. And you went away.
And Chris, how did you feel about all of this that was going on? Your life had been turned upside down.
I don't think I had enough time to really figure out what effect it had, other than I'm in this room, and like now, if someone is like in a room, you have some different things that you can entertain yourself with, like radio, TV, etc. I didn't have any of those things. I got a paint by number set. I got a couple of coloring books. I got a couple of paperback books from the cart that went around. But anything that came in the room had to stay in the room.
Really?
And anything that came in the room had to be treated or radiated or whatever before it came in the room, so that it didn't bring bugs with me or with it. And during my stay in the hospital, during the kind of the whole period of time I was in the hospital, like 38 months, and I ended up having pneumonia, I think 34, 35 times. So you could have a sniffle and I would get pneumonia.
Were you able to talk to your family while you were stuck in that room?
Not very easily, because there were no phones in the room. There was a payphone that, in order to use it, I had to impose or get someone to do me a favor and get me coins to use the payphone. And for a very long time, I didn't have money to do that, because I went in the room and things were kind of frozen. I was in limbo. It was just
Go ahead.
It was isolation was a interesting experience for someone that is social and likes people and likes to talk. And my talking was really limited to the corpsmen that came by and the nurses, to a much lesser extent the doctors. But they came in, they were busy, they didn't have an hour to sit and talk. And later on, I spent time talking to chaplains that would come by once in a while. But it was weird. It was just a weird experience.
Jerry, if you can think back to when this was all happening, what were you and the other members of your family aware of at this time?
Not a whole lot, because like he's talking about, the phones were not like they are today. You know, we had just got a phone at the house. We didn't receive many phone calls. There was no communication, you know. The only time we'd ever hear from him would be, you know, when he got out and got a call and, we talked a few minutes and that was it. But no, we didn't have the text, email, phone in your hand all the time like you do now. So this, you know, we're talking about the late 60s, you know.
Were you guys worried or just sort of not sure what was happening? What kinds of emotions were happening at home while Chris was stuck in this room?
Worried, not sure what was happening. Praying a lot. Just in that situation, you know, we just didn't know, you know, nobody had never heard of this disease that he had, you know, why he was in isolation, you know, why, you know, we couldn't bring him to a hospital in South Carolina where we could go see him, you know, and just whenever he left Texas, they sent him to Seattle, and, you know, that was even further away. So they first called us, he was in Fort Polk. We went down there to see him for a few days, and then they told us we had to leave. He was in isolation. I mean, we couldn't see him, couldn't talk to him, couldn't, you know, really communicate with him. So we just left and come back home.
Right. Well, Chris, you're about to tell me about leaving Fort Polk.
When I left Fort Polk, I went to Fort Sam Houston. And one of the doctors that I lucked into getting there had gone through the University of Washington system. And he was a senior doctor. He had a rank of colonel at the time I got there. And by the time I left, he was promoted to a one-star general. So he had a little bit of horsepower behind being able to assist me in getting places and getting introductions to people, et cetera. And when they had done all they could do for me there, he recommended that I go to Seattle. And he had contacts in Seattle that he would call and tell them I was coming, et cetera, et cetera. And it turned out to be a good thing because that's where I met Dr. Thomas, who later was in charge of doing the transplant, and you probably know more about than maybe some of the others. But another doctor that I, whose care I went under because I was in the military, was Robert Evans. And he was chief of medicine at the VA center in Seattle. And he was also like the, they said, the top one or two in the world in reactionary hemolytic anemias. So he was a professor, worked with Dr. Thomas and a Dr. Goldfinch at the university, and it all kind of just slowly melded together with the different tests and stuff that they were doing.
When you arrived in Seattle, did they still think you had paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria?
Yes. One of the first things I had to do before I could leave the hospital was to rehearse and regurgitate basically everything about PNH and the reactionary hemolytic anemias, so that if something happened and I was outside of the bubble, that I would be able to educate whoever was treating me as to what was needed, required, and what I needed to do now and who needed to be called. And I had home phone numbers and direct lines and all that kind of stuff to the Dr. Evans. And I don't remember if I did for Dr. Thomas or not, but there was a couple of those types of people that I had like a direct line to, in case anything happened, and, you know, call them day or night kind of thing. And
how did you get to Seattle from Texas?
I flew on an airplane. I went home to see the folks for a couple of weeks, I guess. And then I went from Seattle, or went from South Carolina to Seattle. And
did they make you do anything special on the airplane since you had been in isolation, or nothing in particular?
No. Not that I remember anything special.
And you got to Seattle. Were you at the VA hospital there?
Yes.
What happened next?
I started running tests and I started being evaluated, and I got to a level where they thought it was safe for me to go outside, if you will. And I ended up getting a little apartment and to get on with life, I enrolled in a junior college and started taking classes, and I just had to be careful, like, what I was doing. I sat kind of like at the back of the room or away from the door, or watched like how I was mingling with people, did a lot of washing my hands and all that kind of stuff. At one point, there were instances where, even back in the day, I wore masks, which was, it was interesting with the past COVID stuff that we've gone through to flash back and remember how people reacted when almost no one wore a mask, and here I am walking around with a mask on, and they wanted to know what was wrong. I had lots of interesting experiences with people that were just curious and would come up and ask questions. Are you okay? You feel all right? You don't look so good. Maybe you should go see a doctor, kind of stuff.
What was that like?
I learned to take it with, a sense of humor. Be gracious about it. Thank them for being concerned. I also learned to modify what I was telling people, because some were really interested when they asked the question, and they were interested in the information or the story that you were telling them, and others asked the question and they really didn't want to know the answer, or they didn't know how to handle the information once you started telling them, and you could see the facial characteristics and stuff change, the body language change. So I learned how to sort of read the room, and if I didn't think they could handle the information, then I would abbreviate it or change it a little bit so that I didn't totally scare them away.
I imagine that your friends in Seattle knew about your health issues.
Yes, I started out having quite a few I made quite a few friends, but as time went on and I started spending more and more time in the hospital, I found out that there's a difference between having an acquaintance and having a friend. And I probably ended up with three really good friends and, 50 acquaintances.
It does sound, though, that there was a core group of people that really stuck by you.
Yeah, there was. And they were it was okay that something was going on, and they were glad to listen if I wanted to talk about it, but they were not like super nosy and had to talk about it every time they saw me. It became a natural thing instead of an inquisition, where with some people it felt like it was an inquisition.
I imagine at this point you were able to at least talk to your family a little bit more.
Yes. I did create some expensive phone calls. it was not unusual. I was calling particularly my mother, who was kind of the main person that I talked to when I called, because she was there by the phone most of the time. And I would try at other times to call when I knew that my dad might be around or my brother might be around. And I would talk to mom first, and then I would, you know, talk to them a little bit. But, you know, back in the day, it was not unusual to have a phone bill of a couple hundred dollars.
Which was a lot of money at the time. More than it is.
But I didn't have a lot of other expenses, if you will, other than, and it was good to hear their voice. It was good to hear their input. And even if they couldn't do anything about it, just to know that they were there and thinking about you.
So what happened next?
Well, different things with the testing and stuff happened. I ended up starting to improve. I got up to where I was running hematocrits of 11, 12. And at one point, we did a quick routine that was done that kind of jolted the system, and my system responded, and it started making blood cells again, et cetera, and things were looking very rosy.
Do you remember what that treatment was?
No, not really.
That's okay.
The good news, bad news was I started improving and feeling better, and I had taken off from school because I wasn't feeling well, et cetera. And this happened, and I started feeling better, so I'm getting antsy and wanting to do something. And we were looking around for a project I could do. And I wanted to do a fiberglass hatch cover to make an aquarium, a lid for an aquarium, et cetera. I saw it and I thought that would be great as a Christmas present. So I started doing that, and the weather turned, and where I had to do this was an open area under my father-in-law's house. You could open the basement up and get lots of airflow through there. So it was protected. I wasn't getting wet. And I did this, and I even bought masks and all that kind of stuff because the smell was not very nice. And from the day that I did the first application of this, I had the blood test before. It was positive. I got the okay to do this. And so it's like 2 days later, I'm doing this application. Within 24 hours, my blood counts plummeted. It went like a vertical drop. And I felt terrible. And that was Dr. Evans said that one was on him. He didn't see that coming and just totally missed thinking about some of this. But that was the beginning of worse times, if you will, because I never really recovered from that incident. I mean, I kind of creeped up a little bit, but they had been looking at the possibility of this bone marrow transplant, but it was out in the future and they were working on some of the details of getting it done. By the time this happened, it was a lot closer, and it was probably close to a year before it actually came to fruition that I had the bone marrow transplant from this incident. But
did you end up back in the hospital for a long time?
Yeah, I went back in the hospital, and I was in and out for, I would go in on like a Monday morning and get a blood test, and usually got a top off, I called it. I would get a unit of blood and then would go to like Friday and have it checked again and may or may not get another unit to get through it. I went from doing that to being in the hospital. And getting up to where I had the bone marrow transplant, things had been going downhill, and I ended up getting an infection. And had a really rough time. High temperature. I ran a temperature of like 106 for 7 days. And I tried different things, and nothing seemed to be working. I was taking morphine injections, and one of the things that is significant to me is that I had been in bed and I had the temperature and they were doing all the things they could to make me comfortable, et cetera, et cetera. I'm on the bed, and when they made the bed, they didn't put the call button back where it was, I could reach it. They had forgot and put it on the wall. So I called out and no one heard me. And after calling a number of times, I thought, well, I'll just get up and get it myself. And I got up, got out of the bed, and the call button was like 4 steps away. And in the process of going that 4 steps, I ended up to basically fainting or doing something. And but at the time this is going on, I have this like 107 degree temperature, and I was like hot, and I went into this shivering, almost a convulsive kind of state. I couldn't control things. And along the way, both from being a kid growing up, et cetera, and talking with different chaplains and stuff, I had picked out stories of different people from the Bible that I had read about and tried to understand more, et cetera, and reading through the different material. And one of them was Job, and how he had gone through all these trials and lost everything. And God told him that he would never give him more than he could handle. At that is like a microphone in my head. God will not give you more than you can handle. And I remember very clearly talking to God and saying, okay, I understand you wouldn't give me more than I could handle, etc. But I'm telling you, I'm done. I can't handle anymore, etc., etc. So this is like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I end up, passing out. The next thing I remember, it is 7:30 in the morning. And at about 5 o'clock, they came in to give me meds, et cetera, took my temperature. And the temperature had gone from like 107 down to 105. And then by 6:30, I think it was, it had gone down to 103. And by rounds at 7:30, 8 o'clock-ish, it had gone down to 99. And they came back and checked about 9:30, 10 o'clock, and the temperature was down to normal, and they let me go home. They gave me a pass to go out. And that was like this just interesting thing that happened along the way. No way to explain it, but it happened. But it was a preview to something that happened a while later, when I had been sick again and things had been going downhill, and I pretty much was in the bed 24/7. And testing had been done, and they were debating on doing the bone marrow transplant. And the doctor at the VA that was immediately taking care of me under Dr. Evans' supervision kind of thing, he comes in, and he's a good looking guy, all business, no fooling around, just very kind of like a New York personality. Just so he comes in and he starts talking about cars and girls and dating and skiing, all things that I had tried to establish some kind of rapport with him about before, because he wasn't that much older than I was. He was like 30 years old. Mm-hmm. And he had been polite, but, you know, refocused the conversation or redirected the conversation to business. Mm-hmm. So this time he's talking about all this other stuff, and he actually is sitting down, and he picked up one magazine that one of the ladies had dropped off with, I think it might have been cars or something. And he's looking at it, and he's turning it around and showing me, you know, the picture of the car, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, I'm enjoying having this conversation with you, Dr. Parker, but what's up? He said, what are you talking about? I said, well, this is out of character for you. And it's kind of like you want to tell me something or ask me something, but you're not quite sure how to do it. And he gets this kind of sheepish grin on his face. And he says, well, I do. And I said, well, let's have it. And he said, well, it's kind of like a good news, bad news scenario. And I said, okay, you pick. We only have two, you pick, you go. He said, well, your meds, your counts, your everything is going down. And it doesn't seem like you're getting much better. And so we've decided that we're going to try and do the bone marrow if you want to. I said, okay, well, that's good news, right? He says, well, yeah, kind of. I said, what's not good about it? He said, well, the estimate is that you probably only have like a 10% chance of pulling through it. I said, well, geez, if that's the good news, what's the bad news? And he said, if you decide not to take the bone marrow transplant, you've got like a week to live. And so at that point, the world felt really heavy. And he goes off, and that was like late morning, early afternoon. And a friend that was a chaplain came in about 4:30 that night, maybe 5 o'clock. And he ended up staying with me and talking. And we talked to probably, I don't know, 10, 11 o'clock at night. It was well past visiting hours, and he was still there. And before he left, we prayed together. And when he left, I felt like I still had this 1,000 pounds on my shoulders, just like I was being pushed into the ground. And so I go to sleep. And when I woke up the next morning, I felt refreshed. I felt up, I felt positive, I felt good. And later that morning, I went over to Hutchison and to see Dr. Storr. And he's going through giving me the bad news kind of stuff of what possibly could happen and what I needed to look forward to and consider and all of that kind of talk. And he looked like he had bags under his eyes, more like suitcases maybe. And we had gotten to be on kind of a personal level over the time I'd been going over there. And I looked at him and I said, you look like you could use a good night's sleep. And he said, Well, yeah, probably could. I've been doing X, Y, and Z, and, you know, we're got all these different things going on. And I said, well, will you do me a favor? And he said, if I can, sure. And I said, I would like you to go home and get a good night's sleep and not worry about me, because I'm going to be fine. And the dog bobblehead kind of things that you see in cars sometimes, and they kind of turn their head to the side. He did that to me standing there in the hallway. When I said that, he kind of turned his head to the side and said, you know what you're saying? I said, yeah, I'd like you to go get a good night's sleep. I'm going to be fine. And he sort of shakes his head and he goes off down the hallway. And as it turned out, I had the bone marrow transplant, and there were different things that happened to my brother, but I was fine. No graft versus host disease, no hiccups or bumps in the road. I just sailed right through it. In terms of all the things they thought could happen, might happen, and none of that did.
So, Jerry, I think your part is really coming up now. When did you first hear you might have something to do with this?
They called me and asked me if I'd be willing to give him a transplant, and I told them that I would. And so,
did you know what a transplant was at the time? They weren't super common.
I did not, but I went to Conway Hospital, and, you know, they took some blood and sent it to see if I was compatible with him, and they found out that I was, and I was that I was the only one that could be a donor. So they flew me to Seattle. I don't remember now, in the summer of 71, and I stayed out there till Christmas, you know, doing tests, taking tests, and I don't remember all the dates, but I remember I was home by Christmas of 71, but I don't know what you want to hear. I don't know.
Can you tell me about what it was like when they actually harvested the bone marrow from you?
I really couldn't tell anything different. I was sore the next day, you know, when I've been in car wrecks and fell and that kind of stuff, you know, you just kind of sore. And I really couldn't tell any adverse effects, you know, no after effects or whatever.
One of the things that did happen is that after they I think this might have been later, but at one point he would go in for that's it. He gave the bone marrow, and then a couple of days later, he started going in, and he would lay on this table, and they would literally collect more of the red blood cells. And he had all of his blood was filtered, et cetera, and they would get so much. I don't know, it was like a pint a day or something, or some amount that they would then give me to help mine along, kind of like priming the pump.
Got it.
And on one of these days, something happened where he was supposed to have the shit washed out, if you will, And then I forget what the drug was, but it was to be injected into the shunt over like a 15-minute period of time. And something happened, and the nurse did it all at one time. And he went into cardiac arrest.
Wow.
And so they're doing this code blue thing, and I'm in room X, and it's half dozen doors down the way, and they were far enough away that I couldn't tell exactly what was going on, but I see a lot of familiar faces going in that direction, and I kind of know what's in that room that they're going in and out of, and that my brother, I think, still in there. And that was a extremely weird scenario.
Wow. When did you find out that he was okay and that and learn about what had happened?
I found out he was okay hours later, and it was probably like a full day, like not the next day, but the following day, he felt good enough to come in and physically say hello.
Gary, that sounds really scary.
Yeah, it happened 3 days in a row. Same thing. First day, they shot it all in, and I went into cardiac arrest, and then the next day, they spread it out over a period of time, and it still went into cardiac arrest, and the third day, they done the same thing, and it done it again, and they finally just, quit giving me that drug and just let me go with my blood thin. I couldn't shave, couldn't go nowhere, couldn't do nothing that I would take a chance on cutting myself because I would have bled out, but anyway, they couldn't. I can't remember the name now, if it was protamine or heparin, whichever one it was.
Yeah.
One's given to thin the blood to go through the machine, and then the other one was given to thicken it back up to where, I wouldn't bleed out if something would have happened to me, but anyway, they'd done it 3 days in a row.
Did you guys at the time feel like this was something that the team did all the time, or did it still feel like something that was relatively new?
It was my understanding it was relatively new. Chris was one of the early ones.
Mm-hmm. I was number 29.
They had done it a few times in Germany, but they hadn't done very many in the United States.
How are your parents handling all of this?
Mama come out there for a while and Daddy come for a while, and I'm just in like a week or so, but they've done all right, considering everything. By the time that I had got on the machine and was having the trouble with the medicines, Ma had gone back home, so she didn't find out about none of that. She was at home, and we were calling I certainly wouldn't say every day, but we were calling occasionally to, let her know we were all right, everything was all right. Chris was married at the time, but I was not. Mm-hmm. And I call a girlfriend, which later became my first wife. I call her, occasionally and talk to her, and then she'd call Ma and tell her that we was all right, So And I wouldn't say we called home every day, but we called home, you know, several times a week.
And Chris, it sounds like the actual transplant went pretty smoothly for you.
It did. The actual transplant went smooth for me. Like I say, it, you know, was no big deal. Not for me. I mean, I was just a donor. I didn't do anything.
It went smoothly for me also. One of the big things at the time was graft versus host disease. And I did not get that. My different blood counts and stuff started going up. My resistance to things started building, but over the period of time after that, I ended up having all the childhood diseases again. I had mumps, measles, chickenpox. There was one period of time when my son was in, I think it was first grade, second grade. He goes off to school and he came home with the chickenpox. And by the time I get him healthy to return to school, I came down with chickenpox. And we went through that cycle so that I had the chickenpox, two flavors of mumps, or two flavors of measles and a mumps. But I had four different ones. And the neighbors would bring me groceries and put them on the doorstep, if you will. And I'm inside with the kid. And we were in there together. And when he got better, he would go to school. And we had a time. But I ended up doing okay, other than I had to be careful of like going to the store. I would go first thing in the morning when they first opened. Went to gas stations where they pump the gas for you instead of going out. What else?
Was there a time when you found that you didn't need to modify your activities as much?
I was more gradual, and I went back to, let's see, I had the transplant in November, and then I went back to school second No, I stayed out of school until summer school. I went back summer school of 72. And then in doing that, it was just kind of being aware of what was going on, and not if I saw someone like with the runny nose, I give them a wide berth, or, you know, that kind of stuff. I can't think of anything special at the moment that I was doing or not doing.
Was there a time when you kind of felt like, wow, I've moved past this, or has it always felt like it's been still affecting your life or been a part of you?
Uh, for the most part, I've always felt like it was a part of my life. And because I was number 29 to have it, to have the transplant. And turns out, as the years go by, I am, you know, longer living, et cetera, et cetera. I wasn't supposed to be able to have kids. And when the, I had one before I had the transplant. When I was taking the drugs, I was told to be aware that there was a pretty good chance that if I was able to impregnate someone, that the kid would have birth defects because of all the drugs. And then now you move forward with all of this. They had to be
Did you end up having more children?
Two more.
What kind of career did you pursue?
Well, I got a BA in speech and psychology from Seattle Pacific, with a minor in drama and economics. And I came to San Diego to go to graduate school in psychology, because when I was in Seattle, I met some pretty interesting people, and they convinced me that I probably would enjoy coming to San Diego and going to USIU and taking classes from them. And so I did seminars with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. I had classes from Carl Rogers, Viktor Frankl, Hal Greenberg. I could name drop some more, but it was an interesting time here. And
and then did you,
having said all of that, I was planning on going and working with death and dying families, etc., significant trauma. And when I had been starting my career and coming down here, I got part of it paid for by the VA. And I got far enough along that I was paying for my education out of pocket. And I didn't need to have a student loan. And I saw that lots of people were taking student loans. And at the time, they were like literally trying to stuff money in your pocket. And I decided to come south and do psychology instead of going to medical school. Dr. Evans championed me going to medical school and into oncology, hematology, et cetera, because one of the cool things I did was I was the final exam for the residents at the University of Washington for a couple of years. And he would introduce me, and then I got to sit on this table in front of the room, and you got this room full of white coats, and we sat there and had a conversation for an hour. Mm-hmm. But I'm looking at, by the time I did all of that, if I was lucky, I would be like 44, 45 years old. And I was impatient and I wanted to do it quicker. And I thought that getting the psychology degree would be quicker. And so that's the route I took. And then my first wife passed away and I had a kid that was 3.5 years old. And long story short, I decided to stop and raise him instead of continuing on with the graduate school. And from that, one of the first things, one of the first jobs that I got was an assistant administrator in a psychiatric hospital. And then that led to getting a vice president position at a construction company. And that led to real estate development, commercial real estate. That led to doing some consulting, et cetera. And then I got irritated with how things were going with the education in California. And I complained about it a lot. And I did some work with different politicians on changing things. And that wasn't working like I wanted it to and fast enough. And my oldest son challenged me to make a difference myself. So long story short, I ended up leaving private business and went back to school and got a job teaching. And for, well, for 18 years, I was a middle high school teacher.
Fantastic. What did you teach?
Well, I was contracted to teach English, and I taught second language students how to read and write. That was, and then I really wanted to teach drama or history, and neither one of those happened to be in the cards. I did have enough background with the economic stuff that I taught business. And I, when I was not under contract, I did long-term sub positions. So instead of doing it one day, this classroom, next day, a different classroom, I got into going in and taking over for you when you were out on a surgical leave or a maternity leave or you had an accident or something like that. So I was in the classroom with the same kids for weeks at a time instead of days at a time.
Fantastic. Chris, I'm wondering these days, how does or does not, how does your experience with being ill affect you? Do you still take medications related to the transplant?
Yes. I have continued to be followed and participate in surveys and stuff that that they do. And once a year I go through and answer questionnaires and have the doctors I'm seeing respond to different questions that Hutchison has. Well, there are things that are still in play. As an example, I have type 2 diabetes, and come to find out that about 37% of people that go through a bone marrow transplant get type 2 diabetes. I am still sensitive to certain smells. You could have ants in your house and spray black flag, if you will. And I could come in 3 or 4 days later, and within 5 minutes of being in your house, feel like you were beating me in the temples with hammers. Paint, oil-based paint, anything that has benzene in it. So if I got really crazy and wanted to smell gasoline, as an example, that wouldn't be very good. But I've just had to learn along the way different things that may or may not have the benzene chemicals in it. And to read labels, if it says do not breathe, I try not to breathe. So
is at the end of the day, did they settle on PNH as the diagnosis?
Yes.
Well, I want to thank you, and I want to thank you, Jerry, for joining us today. This was really a tremendous conversation and opportunity to hear about what things were like from both of your perspectives. And we're so grateful that we got to chat.
Thank you for listening to the Cancer History Project podcast, a podcast of oral histories and interviews with the people who have shaped oncology as we know it. Our archives are available online for free at cancerhistoryproject.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @cancerhistproj. The Cancer History Project is a collaborative historical resource operated by the Cancer Letter. This is an ongoing project and would not be possible without the input and materials provided by our editorial board, our contributors, and the support of our sponsors, including Cedars-Sinai, Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, MD Anderson Cancer Center, and many others. View a full list of our sponsors at cancerhistoryproject.com/sponsors. If your institution would like to participate in the Cancer History Project, email us at admin@cancerhistoryproject.com.